His right leg was in an inflatable pressure cast. The foot sticking out the end was a bluish purple, and his breath was labored in a way that made her think of pneumonia, of internal bleeding. Melbico, civilian electrochemical tech off the Cerisier.
Who do you answer to?
Mickelson's my group supervisor, she said, struggling to remember the man's name. She had only met him once, and he hadn't left much of an impression on her.
My name's Nikos, the broken-legged man said. You work for me now. Come on.
He pushed off more gracefully than should have been possible. She followed him a little too fast and had to grab a handhold to keep from running into his back. He led her through a long passageway into engineering. A huge array of thin metal and ceramic sheets stood at one wall, warnings in 8 languages printed along its side. Scorch marks drew circles on the outermost plate, and the air stank of burnt plastic and something else. A hole, 2 feet across, had been punched through the center. A human body was still in it, held in place by shards of metal.
You know what that is, Co?
Air processing, she said.
That's the primary atmosphere processing unit, he said, as if she hadn't spoken. And it's a big damn problem. Secondary processors still on fire just at the moment, and the tertiary backups will get us through for about 7 hours. Everyone on my team is busted or dead. So you're about to rebuild this one. Understand?
I can't do that, she thought. I'm not really an electrochemical technician. I don't know how to do this. I'll get my tools.
Don't let me stop you, he said. If I find someone can help out, I'll send him your way.
That would be good, she said. What about you? Are you all right? Can you help?
At a guess? Crushed pelvis. Maybe something worse going on in my gut. Keep passing out a little, he said with a grin. But I'm high as a kite on the emergency speed, and there's work. So hop to.
She pushed off. Her throat was tight, and she could feel her mind starting to shut down. Overstimulation. Shock. She made her way through the carnage and wreckage to the storage bay where the toolboxes from the Cerisier were. Her card unlocked them. One had shattered, the remains of a testing deck floating in the air, green ceramic shards and bits of gold wire. Wren was there. His coffin toolbox shifted in place despite the electromagnetic clamps. For a moment, the dream of the fire washed over her. She wondered if she might still be sleeping, the wave of death just part of the same blackness in her own brain. She put her hand on Wren's box, half expecting to feel him knocking back. A sudden vertigo washed through her, and the sense that she and the ship were falling. That it would land on her, crush her. All the blood and all the terror, every dead person held in place to keep the corpse from floating, they all began here. Every sin she'd committed, backward and forward in time, had its center in the bones beneath her hand. Stop, she said. Just stop. She took her tool chest, the real one, and sped back to engineering and the shattered air processing controller. Nikos had found 2 other people, a man in civilian dress and an older woman in naval uniform.
Your co? The woman said. Good, grab his legs.
Melba set her toolbox against the deck and activated the magnets, then pushed over to the hole in the atmosphere processor. The machine had been loosed from its housing, giving the body a little more room to move. Melba put her hands on the dead man's thighs, wadding the cloth of his trousers in her fists. She braced herself against the metal siding of the unit.
Ready? The man asked.
Ready. The woman counted down from 3, and Melba pulled. For a long moment, she thought the corpse wouldn't come out, but then something tore. The vibrations of it transferring through to her hands. The body slid free.
Score 1 for the good guys, Nico said from across the bay. His face was developing an ashy, gray tone, like he was dying. She wished he would go to the medical bays, but they were probably swamped. He could die here, doing his work, or there, waiting for an open bay.
Clear him away. Got him out. We don't need him drifting back.
Melba nodded, took a firm grip, and pushed off on a trajectory that would land them on the far bulkhead. The back of the corpse's head had been crushed almost flat, but death had come so swiftly there was very little blood. At the wall, she secured him with a spray of foam and held him for a moment while it set. The dead man's face was close to hers. She could see the whiskers he'd missed when he'd shaved, the brown of his empty eyes. She felt a sudden urge to kiss him, and then pushed the impulse away, disgusted. From his uniform, he'd been an officer, lieutenant, maybe. The white identity card on the lanyard around his neck had a picture of him looking solemn. She took it in her fingers. Not lieutenant. Lieutenant commander. Lieutenant commander Stepan Arsenal, who would never have come through the ring if it weren't for her. Who wouldn't have died here. She tried to feel guilt, but there wasn't room for him inside of her. She had too much blood already. She was reaching out to tuck his card back in place when the small voice in the back of her mind said, "I bet he could get an EVA pack with this." Melba blinked. Her mind seemed to click back into focus, and she looked around her, the last wisps of dream or delirium leaving her mind. She had access to the equipment she needed. The ship was in chaos. This was it. This was the opportunity she'd been waiting for. She plucked the card off its lanyard and slipped it in her pocket, then looked around nervously. No one had noticed. She licked her lips.
"I'm going to need something to crack this," the young man was saying. "The bolt head's sheared round. I can't get it out."
The older woman swore and turned to her.
"Got anything that'll do the trick?"
"Not here," Melba said. "I have an idea where I could get something to drill it out, though."
"Move fast. We don't want this place getting stuffy."
"Okay. You guys do what you can. I'll be right back," Melba lied. Chapter 24. Anna. Eschatology had always been Anna's least favorite study of theology. When asked about Armageddon, she'd tell her parishioners that God himself had been pretty circumspect on the topic, so it didn't do much good to worry about it. Have faith that God will do what's best, and avoiding his vengeance against the wicked should be the least compelling reason for worship. But the truth was that she'd always had a deeply held disagreement with most futurist and millennialist interpretations. Not the theology itself, necessarily, since their guess at what the end-time prophecies really meant was as good as anyone else's. Her disagreement was primarily with the level of glee over the destruction of the wicked that sometimes crept into the teachings. This was especially true in some millennialist sects that filled their literature with paintings of Armageddon, pictures of terrified people running away from some formless, fiery doom that burned their world down behind them, while smug worshippers, of the correct religion, of course, watched from safety as God got with the smiting. Anna couldn't understand how anyone could see such a depiction as anything but tragic. She wished she could show them the Thomas Prince. She'd been reading when it happened. Her hand terminal had been propped on her chest with a pillow behind it, her hands behind her head. A three-tone alarm had sounded a high G alert, but it was late to the party. She was already being mashed into her crash couch so hard that she could feel the plastic of the base right through 20 centimeters of impact gel. It seemed to last forever, but it was probably just a few seconds. Her hand terminal had skidded down her chest, suddenly heavier than Nami the last time she'd picked her daughter up.
It left a black and blue trail of bruises up her breastbone and slammed into her chin hard enough to split the skin. The pillow mashed into her abdomen like a 10-kilo sandbag, filling her mouth with the taste of stomach acid. But worst of all was the pain in her shoulders. Both arms had snapped back flat against the bed, temporarily dislocating them. When the endless seconds of deceleration were over, both joints popped back into place with a pain even worse than when they'd come out. The gel of the couch, stretched beyond its design specifications, hadn't gripped her the way it was meant to. Instead, it rebounded back into its prior shape and launched her in slow motion toward the ceiling of her cabin. Trying to put her hands in front of her sent bolts of agony through her shoulders, so she drifted up and hit the ceiling with her face. Her chin left a smear of blood on the fabric-covered foam. Anna was a gentle person. She'd never in her life been in a fight. She'd never been in a major accident. The worst pain she'd ever felt before was childbirth, and the endorphins that had followed had mostly erased it from her memory. To suddenly be so hurt in so many different places at once left her dazed with a sort of directionless anger. It wasn't fair that a person could be hurt so much. She wanted to yell at the crash couch that had betrayed her by letting this happen, and she wanted to punch the ceiling for hitting her in the face, even though she'd never thrown a punch in her life and could barely move her arms. When she could finally move without feeling lightheaded, she went looking for help and found that the corridor outside her room was worse. Just a few meters from her door, a young man had been crushed. He looked as though a malevolent giant had stomped on him and then ground him under its heel. The boy was not only smashed, but torn and twisted in ways that barely left him recognizable as a human. His blood splashed the floor and walls and drifted around his corpse in red balls like grisly Christmas ornaments. Anna yelled for help. Someone yelled back in a voice filled with liquid and pain. Someone from farther down the corridor. Anna carefully pushed off the door jamb of her room and drifted toward the voice. Two rooms down, another man was half in and half out of his crash couch. He must have been in the process of getting out of bed when the deceleration happened, and everything from his pelvis down was twisted and broken. His upper torso still lay on the bed, arms waving feebly at her, his face a mask of pain. "Help me," he said, and then coughed up a glob of blood and mucus that drifted away in a red and green ball. Anna drifted up high enough to push the comm panel on the wall without using her shoulder. It was dead. All the lights were the ones she'd been told came on in emergency power failures. Nothing else seemed to be working. "Help me," the man said again. His voice was weaker and filled with even more of a liquid rasp. Anna recognized him as Alonso Guzman, a famous poet from the UN South American region, a favorite of the Secretary General, someone had told her. "I will," Anna said, not even trying to stop the tears that suddenly blinded her. She wiped her eyes on her shoulder and said, "Let me find someone. I've hurt my arms, but I'll find someone." The man began weeping softly. Anna pushed back into the corridor with her toes, drifting past the carnage to find someone who wasn't hurt. This was the part the millennialists never put in their paintings. They loved scenes of righteous, godly vengeance on sinful mankind. They loved to show God's chosen people safe from harm, watching with happy faces as they were proved right to the world. But they never showed the aftermath. They never showed weeping humans, crushed and dying in pools of their own fluids, young men smashed into piles of red flesh, a young woman cut in half because she was passing through a hatchway when catastrophe hit. This was Armageddon. This is what it looked like. Blood and torn flesh, and cries for help. Anna reached an intersection of corridors and ran out of strength. Her body hurt too badly to continue, and in all four directions the corridor floors and walls were covered with the aftermath of violent death. It was too much. Anna drifted in the empty space for a few minutes, and then she gently floated to the wall and stuck to it. Movement. The ship was moving now. Very slow, but enough to push her to the wall. She pushed away from it and floated again, not still accelerating then. She recognized that her interest in the relative movements of the ship was just her mind trying to find a distraction from the scene around her, and started crying again. The idea that she might never come home from this trip crashed in on her. For the first time since coming to the ring, she saw a future in which she never held Nami again, never smelled her hair, never kissed Nono, or climbed into a warm bed beside her and held her close. The pain of those things being ripped away from her was worse than anything physical she'd suffered. She didn't wipe away the tears that came, and they blinded her. That was fine. There was nothing here she wanted to see. When something grabbed her from behind and spun her around, she tensed, waiting for some new horror to reveal itself. It was Tilly. "Oh, thank God," the woman said, hugging Anna tight enough to send new waves of pain through her shoulders. "I went to your room and there was blood on the walls and you weren't there and someone was dead right outside your door." Unable to hug back, Anna just put her cheek against Tilly's for a moment. Tilly pushed her out to arm's length but didn't let go. "Are you okay?" She was looking at the gash on Anna's chin. "My face is fine, just a little cut, but my arms are hurt. I can barely move them. We need to get help. Alonso Guzman's in his room and he's hurt, really hurt. Do you know what happened?" "I haven't met anyone yet who knows," Tilly said, rotating Anna first one way, then the other, looking her over critically. "Move your hands. Okay, bend your elbows." She felt Anna's shoulders. "They're not dislocated." "I think they were for a second," Anna said after the gasp of pain Tilly's touch brought. "And everything else hurts. But we have to hurry." Tilly nodded and pulled a red and white backpack off one shoulder. When she opened it, it was filled with dozens of plastic packages with tiny black text on them. Tilly pulled a few out, read them, put them back. After several tries, she stripped the packaging off three small injection ampoules. "What is that?" Anna said, but Tilly just jabbed her with all three in answer. Anna felt a rush of euphoria wash over her. Her shoulders stopped hurting, everything stopped hurting. Even her fear about never seeing her family again seemed a distant and minor problem. "I was sleeping when it happened," Tilly said, tossing the empty ampules into the first aid pack. "But I woke up feeling like a forklift had run over me. I think my ribs were popped out of place. I could barely breathe. So I dug up this pack from the emergency closet in my room." "I didn't think to look there," Anna said, surprised she hadn't. She had a vague memory of being disoriented by pain, but now she felt great, better than ever before. And sharp, hyper-aware. Stupid not to think of the emergency supplies. This being, after all, an emergency. She wanted to slap herself on the forehead for being so stupid. Tilly was holding her arms again. Why was she doing that? They had work to do. They had to find the medics and send them after the poet. "Hey, kiddo," Tilly said. "Takes a second for that first rush to ease down a bit. I spent a full minute trying to resuscitate a pile of red paste before I realized how wired I was." "What is this?" Anna asked, moving her head from side to side, which made the edges of Tilly's face blurry. Tilly shrugged. "Military-grade amphetamines and painkillers, I'm guessing. I gave you an anti-inflammatory, too. Because, what the hell?" "Are you a doctor?" Anna asked, marveling at how smart Tilly was. No, but I can read the directions on the package.
Okay, Anna nodded, her face serious. Okay. Let's go find someone who knows what's going on, Tilly said, pulling Anna down the corridor with her.
And after, I need to find my people, Anna said, letting herself be pulled. I may have given you too much. Nono and Nami are at home, in Moscow. No, my people, my congregation. Chris and that other guy and the Marine. She's angry, but I think I can talk to her. I need to find them.
Yeah, Tilly said. May have overdosed you a bit, but we'll find them. Let's find help first.
Anna thought of the poet and felt her tears threatening to return. If she was sad, maybe the initial rush of the drugs was wearing off a little. She found herself regretting that for a moment. Tilly stopped at a printed deck map on the wall. It was right next to a black and unresponsive network panel. Of course, military ships would have both, Anna thought. They were built with the expectation that things would stop working when the ship got shot. That thought made Anna sad, too. Some distant part of her consciousness recognized the drug-fueled emotional roller coaster she was on, but was powerless to do anything about. She started weeping again. Security station. Tilly tapped on a spot on the map, then yanked Anna down the corridor after her. They made two turns and wound up at a small room filled with people, guns, and computers that seemed to still be working. A middle-aged man with salt-and-pepper hair and a grim expression on his face pointedly ignored them. The other four people in the room were younger, but equally uninterested in their arrival.
Get 35C open first, the older man said to the two young men floating to his left.
He pointed at something on a map.
There were a dozen civvies in there.
EMT? One of the young men asked.
Don't have them to spare. And that galley doesn't have crash couches. Everyone in there is pasta sauce, but the LT says look anyway.
Roger that, the young man replied, and he and his partner pushed out of the room past Anna and Tilly, barely glancing at them as they went.
You two do a corridor sweep, the older man said to the other two young sailors in the room. Tags if you can find them. Pictures and swabs if you can't. Everything sent to Opcom on Red 2-1, got me?
Aye, aye. One of them said, and they floated out of the room.
The man in 295 needs help, Anna said to the security officer. He's hurt badly. He's a poet.
He tapped something onto his desk terminal and said,
Okay, he's in the queue. EMTs will get there as soon as they can. We're setting up a temporary emergency area in the officer's mess. I suggest you two ladies get there double time.
What happened? Tilly asked, and gripped a handhold on the wall like she meant to stay a while.
Anna grabbed on to the nearest thing she could find, which turned out to be a rack of weapons. The security officer looked Tilly up and down once and seemed to come to the conclusion that giving her what she wanted was the easiest solution.
Hell if I know. We decelerated to a dead stop in just a shade under 5 seconds. The damage and injuries are all high-G trauma. Whatever grabbed us only grabbed the skin of the ship and didn't give a shit about the stuff inside.
So, the slow zone changed? Tilly was asking.
Anna looked over the guns in the rack, her emotions more under control, but her mind was still racing. The rack was full of pistols of various kinds, big, blocky ones with large barrels and fat magazines, smaller ones that looked like the kind you saw on cop shows, and in a special rack all their own, tasers, like the one she'd had on Europa. Well, not really like it. These were military models, gray and sleek and efficient-looking, with a much bigger power pack than hers. In spite of their non-lethal purpose, they managed to appear dangerous. Her old taser at home had looked like a small hairdryer.
Don't touch those, the security officer said.
Anna hadn't even realized she was reaching for one until he said it.
That could mean a damn lot of casualties, Tilly said. Anna had the feeling she was re-entering the conversation after having missed a lot of it.
Hundreds on the Prince, the security officer said,
and we weren't going anywhere near the old speed limit. Some of the ships were. We get no broadcasts from those now.
Anna looked at the various terminals working in the office around her. Damage reports and security feeds and orders. Anna couldn't understand much of them. They used a lot of acronyms and numbers for things, military jargon. One small monitor was displaying pictures of people. Anna recognized James Holden in one, then another version of him with a patchy beard. Wanted posters? But she didn't recognize any of the other people until the sculpture of the girl that Naomi, Holden's second-in-command, had blamed for the attack. Maybe it was the space girl, Anna said before she'd realized she was going to. She still felt stoned and suppressed an urge to giggle. The security officer and Tilly were both staring at her. Anna pointed at the screen. Julie Mao, the girl from Eros, the one the Rosinante blamed. Maybe she did this. Both the security officer and Tilly turned to look at the screen. A few seconds later, the image of Julie the space girl disappeared and was replaced by someone Anna didn't recognize.
Someone's going to get James Holden in an interrogation room for a few hours, and then we'll have a much better idea where to put the blame.
Tilly just laughed.
Is that who they blamed? She said when she'd finished.
That isn't Julie Mao. And there's no way Claire's out here.
Claire? Anna and the officer said at the same time.
That's Claire. Clarissa Mao, Julie's little sister. She's living on Luna with her mother, last I heard. But that's definitely not Julie.
Are you sure? Anna said. Because the executive officer from the Rosinante said, I dandled both those girls on my knee back in the day. The Maos used to be regular guests at our house in Baja. Brought the kids out during the summers to swim and eat fish tacos. And that one is Claire, not Julie.
Oh, said Anna, as her drug-enhanced mind ran out the entire plot. The angry girl she'd seen in the galley. The explosion of the UN ship. The ridiculous message from Holden's ship followed by the protestations of innocence. It was her. She blew up the ship.
Which ship? The officer asked.
The UN ship that blew up. The one that made the Belter ship shoot at Holden. And then we all went through the ring and she's here. She's on this ship right now. I saw her in the galley and I knew there was something wrong with her. She scared me, but I should have said something, but I didn't because why would I?
Tilly and the security man were both staring at her. She could feel her mind running away with her, and her mouth seemed to be working all on its own. They were looking at her like she'd gone insane.
She's here, Anna said, clamping her mouth shut with an effort.
Claire?
Tilly asked with a frown. I saw her in the galley. She threatened me. She was on this ship.
The security man scowled and tapped something on his terminal, swore, then tapped something else.
I'll be a son of a bitch.
Shipwide face recognition says we've got a match in Hangar B right now.
You have to go arrest her, Anna shouted.
Hangar B is a designated emergency area, the officer said. She's probably there with the other survivors and broken in five different places, if it's even her. Shitty reproduction like that makes for a lot of false positives.
You have software that could have found her at any time? Tilly asked in disbelief. You didn't check?
Ma'am, we don't ask how high when James fucking Holden says jump, the officer growled back.
There's an airlock in there, Anna said, stabbing her hand at the display. She could leave. She could go anywhere.
Like where? The officer replied. As if on cue, a green airlock cycling alarm appeared on the display.
We have to go get her, Anna said, pulling on Tilly's arm.
You have to go to the officer's mess, the security man said. I'll send people to pick her up for questioning as soon as we stop bleeding. Don't worry about it. We've got plenty enough to sort out now. That one'll wait.
But
a young man floated into the room.
The left half of his face was covered in blood. Need the EMTs to 6 Alpha, sir. We've got 10 civvies. I'll see who I can pry free, the officer said. Do we know anything about the condition of the injured? Bones sticking out, but they're not dead. Anna pulled Tilly into the corridor.
We can't wait. She's dangerous. She's already killed people when she blew up the other ship.
You're stoned, Tilly said, pulling her arm free and drifting across the corridor to bump into the wall. You're not acting rationally. What are you going to do, even if Claire Mao is on this ship and has become some sort of terrorist? She blew up a ship. Gonna hit her with your Bible? Anna pulled the taser halfway out of her pocket. Tilly sucked in a whistling breath through her teeth.
You stole that? Are you insane? She asked in a loud whisper.
I'm going to find her, Anna replied, the drugs singing in her blood having focused down to a fine point. She felt like if she could stop this Claire person, she could save herself from losing her family forever. She recognized this idea as utterly irrational and gave in to its power anyway.
I have to talk to her. You're going to get killed, Tilly said.
She looked like she might start crying.
You told security, you did your part, let it go. You're a minister, not a cop.
I'll need an EVA pack. Do you know where they keep those? Are they near the airlocks?
You're insane, Tilly said. I can't be part of this.
It's okay, Anna said. I'll be back.
Chapter 25. Holden. Naomi, Holden said again. Come in. Please. Please respond. The silent radio felt like a threat. Miller had paused, his face bleak and apologetic. Holden wondered how many other people had looked at that exact expression on Miller's face. It seemed designed to go with words like, there's been an accident, and the DNA matches your son's. Holden could feel his hands trembling. It didn't matter. Rosinante, Naomi, come in.
Doesn't mean anything, Miller said. She could be just fine, but the comm array went down. Or maybe she's busy fixing something.
Or maybe she's dying by centimeters, Holden said. I've got to go. I have to get back to her. Miller shook his head.
It's a longer trip back out than it was getting here. You can't go as fast anymore. By the time you get back, she'll have figured out whatever needed figuring.
Or she'll be dead, Miller didn't say. Holden wondered what it meant that the protomolecule could put Miller on its hand like a puppet, and the detective could still be thoughtful enough to leave out the possibility that everyone on the Rossi was gone.
I have to try.
Miller sighed. For a moment, his pupils flickered blue, like they were tiny, bathypelagic fish swimming in the deep trenches of his eyeballs.
You want to help her? You want to help all of them? Come with me. Now. You run back home, you won't get to find out what happened. And you may not get the chance to come back here. Plus, you can bet your friends are regrouping back there, and they can still gently rip your arms off if they catch you.
Holden felt like there were two versions of himself pulling at his mind. Naomi might be hurt, might be dead. Alex and Amos, too. He had to be there for them. But there was also a small, quiet part of himself that knew Miller was right. It was too late. You can tell the station that there are people on those ships, he said. You can ask it to help them.
I can tell Iraq that it ought to be Secretary General. Doesn't mean it's going to listen. All this?
Miller waved his hands at the dark walls.
It's dumb. Utilitarian. No creativity or complex analysis.
Really? Holden said, his curiosity peeking through the panic and anger and fear. Why not?
Some things, it's better if they're predictable. No one wants the station coming up with its own bad ideas.
We should hurry. Where are we going?
Holden said, pausing for a few deep breaths. He'd been at low G for too long without taking the time for exercise. His cardio had suffered. The dangers of growing rich and lazy.
I'm going to need you to do something for me, Miller replied. I need access to the... shit, I don't know. Call 'em records.
Holden finished his panting, then straightened and nodded for Miller to resume their walk. As they moved down the gently sloping corridor, he said,
Aren't you already plugged in? I'm aware. The station is in lockdown, and they didn't exactly give me the root password. I need you to open it up for me.
Not sure what I can do that you can't, Holden said,
other than be a charming dinner guest. Miller stopped at another seeming dead end, touched the wall, and a portal irised open. He gestured Holden through, then followed and closed the door behind them. They were in another large chamber, vaguely octagonal and easily 50 meters long on each face. More of the insectal mechs littered the space, but the glass pillars were not in evidence. Instead, at the center of the chamber stood a massive construct of glowing blue metal. It was octagonal, a smaller version of the dimensions of the room, but only a few meters wide on each face. It didn't glow any brighter than the rest of the room, but Holden could feel something coming off of it, an almost physical pressure that made walking toward it difficult. His suit said that the atmosphere had changed, that it was rich with complex organic chemicals and nitrogen.
Sometimes, having a body at all means you've got a certain level of status. If you aren't pretty damn trusted, you don't get to walk around in the fallen world.
The fallen world? Miller shuddered and leaned his hand out against the wall. It was a profoundly human gesture of distress. The glowing moss of the wall didn't respond at all. Miller's lips were beginning to turn black.
Fallen world. The substrate. Matter. Are you all right? Holden asked.
Miller nodded, but he looked like he was about to vomit.
There's times I start knowing things that are too big for my head. It's better in here. But there are going to be some questions that don't fit in me. Just thinking with all this crap connected to the back of my head is a full contact sport, and if I get too much, I'm pretty sure they'll, call it reboot me. I mean, sure, consciousness is an illusion and blah, 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 but I'd rather not go there if we can help it. I don't know how much the next one would remember.
Holden stopped walking, then turned and gave Miller a hard shove. Both of them staggered backward.
You seem pretty real to me.
Miller held up his finger.
Seem. Good verb. You ever wondered why I leave as soon as anyone else shows up?
I'm special?
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
Fine, Holden said. I'll bite. Why doesn't anyone else see you?
I'm not sure we've got time for this, but...
Miller took off his hat and scratched his head.
So your brain has 100 billion brain cells and about 500 trillion synapses.
Will this be on the test?
Don't be an asshole, Miller said conversationally and put his hat back on. And that shit is custom grown. No two brains are exactly alike. Guess how much processing power it takes to really model even one human brain? More than every human computer ever built put together. And that's before we even start getting to the crap that goes on inside the cells.
Okay.
Now, picture those synapses as buttons on a keyboard. 500 trillion buttons. And say that a brain looking at something and thinking, that's a flower, punches a couple billion of those keys in just the right pattern. Except, it ain't near that easy. It isn't just a flower.
It's a pile of associations. Smells, the way a stem feels in your fingers. The flower you gave your mom once. The flower you gave your girl. A flower you stepped on by accident and it made you sad. And being sad brings on a whole pile of other associations.
I get it, Holden said, holding up his hands in surrender. It's complicated.
Now, picture you need to push exactly the right buttons to make someone think of a person. Hear them speaking. Remember the clothes they wore and the way they smelled and how they would sometimes take off their hat to scratch their head.
Wait, Holden said. Are there bits of protomolecule in my brain?
Not exactly. You may have noticed I'm non-local.
What the hell does that even mean?
Well, Miller said, now you're asking me to explain microwaves to a monkey.
That's a metaphor I've never actually spoken aloud. If you're aiming for not creeping me the hell out, you need more practice.
So, yeah. The most complex simulation in the history of your solar system is running right now so that we can pretend I'm here in the same room with you. The correct response is being flattered. Also, doing what the fuck I need you to do. That would be touching that big thing in the middle of the room.
Holden looked at the construct again, felt the almost subliminal pressure coming off of it.
Why?
Because, said Miller, lecturing to a stupid child, the place is in lockdown. It's not accepting remote connections without a level of authorization I don't have.
And I do?
You're not making a remote connection. You're actually here, in the substrate. In some quarters, that's kind of a big deal. But I just walked in here.
You had some help. I calmed some of the security down to get you this far.
So, you let the Marines in too?
Unlocked is unlocked, come on.
The closer Holden got to the octagon, the harder it was to approach. It wasn't just fear, though the dread swam at the back of his throat and all down his spine. It was physically difficult, like pushing against a magnetic field. The shape was chipped at the edges, marked with hair-thin lines in patterns that might have been ideograms or patterns of fungal growth, or both. He reached out his hand, and his teeth itched.
What will happen? He asked. How much do you know about quantum mechanics?
How much do you? Holden replied.
A lot, turns out, Miller said with a lopsided grin. Do now, anyway.
I'm not going to burst into flames or something, right? Miller gave a small belter shrug with his hands.
Don't think so. I'm not up on all the defense systems, but I don't think so.
So, Holden said. Maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, Holden sighed, and started to reach for the surface. He paused.
You didn't really answer the question, you know.
You're stalling, Miller said, and then,
which question was that?
I get why no one else sees you. But the real question is, why me at all? I mean, okay, you're screwing with my brain, and that's hard work, and if there's other people for me to interact with, it's too hard and all like that. But why me? Why not Naomi, or the UN Secretary General, or something? Miller nodded, understanding the question. He frowned, sighed.
Miller kind of liked you. Thought you were a decent guy.
That's it?
You need more?
Holden placed his palm flat against the closest surface. He didn't burst into flames. Through the gloves of his EVA suit, he felt a short electric tingle, and then nothing, because he was floating in space. He tried to scream, and failed.
Sorry, a voice said in his head. It sounded like Miller. Didn't mean to drag you in here.
Just try and relax, all right? Holden tried to nod, but failed at that too. He didn't have a head. His sense of his own body had changed, shifted, expanded past anything he'd imagined before. The simple extent of it was numbing. He felt the stars within him, the vast expanses of space contained by him. With a thought, he could put his attention to a sun surrounded by unfamiliar planets, like he was attending to his finger or the back of his neck. The lights all tasted different, smelled different. He wanted to close his eyes against the flood of sensation, but he couldn't. He didn't have anything so simple as eyes. He had become immeasurably large and rich and strange. Thousands of voices, millions, billions, lifted in chorus, and he was their song. And at his center, a place where all the threads of his being came together, he recognized the station not by how it looked, but by the deep throb of its heartbeat. The power of a million suns contained, channeled. Here was the nexus that sat between the worlds, the miracle of knowledge and power that gave him heaven, his babble. And a star went out. It wasn't especially unique. It wasn't beautiful. A few voices out of quadrillions went silent, and if the great chorus of his being was lessened by them, it wasn't perceptible. Still, a ripple passed through him. The colors of his consciousness swirled and darkened. Concern, curiosity, alarm, even delight. Something new had happened for the first time in millennia. Another star flickered and failed. Another few voices went silent. Now, slowly and instantly both, everything changed. He felt the great debate raging in him as a fever, an illness. He had been beyond anything like a threat for so long that all the reflexes of survival had weakened, atrophied. Holden felt a fear that he knew belonged to him, the man trapped within the machine, because his larger self couldn't remember to feel it. The vast parliament swirled, thoughts and opinions, analysis and poetry blending together and breaking apart. It was beautiful as sunlight on oil, and terrifying. Three suns failed, and now Holden felt himself growing smaller. It was still very little, almost nothing. A white spot on the back of his hand, a sore that wouldn't heal. The plague was still only a symptom, but it was one his vast self couldn't ignore. From the station at his core, he reached out into the places he had been, the darkened systems that were lost to him, and he reached out through the gates with fire. The fallen stars, mere matter now, empty and dead, bloated, filled their systems in a rage of radiation and heat, sheared the electrons from every atom, and detonated. Their final deaths echoed, and Holden felt a sense of mourning and of peace. The cancer had struck and been burned away. The loss of the minds that had been would never be redeemed. Mortality had returned from exile, but it had been cleansed with fire. 100 stars failed. What had been a song became a shriek. Holden felt his body shifting against itself, furious as a swarm of bees trapped and dying. In despair, the 100 suns were burned away, the station hurling destruction through the gates as fast as the darkness appeared, but the growing shadow could not be stopped. All through his flesh, stars were going out, voices were falling into silence. Death rode the vacuum, faster than light, and implacable. He felt the decision like a seed crystal giving form to the chaos around it. Solid, hard, resolute. Desperation, mourning, and a million farewells, one to the other. The word quarantine came to him. And, with the logic of dreams, it carried an unsupportable weight of horror. But within it, like the last voice in Pandora's box, the promise of reunion. One day, when the solution was found, everything that had been lost would be regained. The gates reopened, the vast mind restored. The moment of dissolution came, sudden and expected, and Holden blew apart. He was in darkness, empty and tiny and lost, waiting for the promise to be fulfilled, waiting for the silent chorus to whisper again that Armageddon had been stopped, that all was not lost. And the silence reigned.
Huh, Miller thought at him. That was weird.
Like being pulled backward through an infinitely long tunnel of light, Holden was returned to his body. For one vertiginous moment, he felt too small, like the tiny wrapping of skin and meat would explode trying to contain him. Then, he just felt tired and sat down on the floor with a thump.
Okay, Miller said, rubbing his cheek with an open palm. I guess that's a start. Sort of explains everything. Sort of nothing. Pain in the ass.
Holden flopped onto his back. He felt like someone had run him through a shredder and then badly welded him back together. Trying to remember what it felt like to be the size of a galaxy gave him a splitting headache, so he stopped.
Tell me everything it explains, he said, when he could remember how to speak.
Being forced to move moist flaps of meat in order to form the words felt sensual and obscene.
They quarantined the systems, shut down the network to stop whatever was capping the locals.
So, behind each of those gates is a solar system full of whatever made the protomolecule? Miller laughed. Something in the sound of it sent a shiver down Holden's spine.
That seems pretty fucking unlikely.
Why?
This station has been waiting for the all-clear signal to open the network back up for about 2 billion years. If they'd found a solve, they wouldn't still be waiting. Whatever it was, I think it got them all.
All of them but you, Holden said.
Nah, kid. I'm one of them, like the Rocinante is one of you.
The Rossi's smart for a machine. It knows a lot about you. It could probably gin up a rough simulation of you if someone told it to.
Those things, the ones you felt like, compared to them, I'm a fancy kind of hand terminal.
And the nothing, it explains, Holden said. You mean what killed them?
Well, if we're going to be fair, it's not really nothing, Miller said, crossing his arms. We know it ate a galaxy-spanning hive consciousness like it was popcorn, so that's something. And we know it survived a sterilization that was a couple hundred solar systems wide.
Holden had a powerfully vivid memory of watching the station hurl fire through the ring gates, of the stars on the other side blowing up like balloons, of the gates themselves abandoned to the fire and disappearing. Even just the echo of it nearly blinded him with remembered pain.
Seriously, did they blow up those stars to stop it?
Holden's image of Miller patted the column at the center of the room, though he knew now that Miller wasn't really touching it. Something was pressing the right buttons on his synaptic keyboard to make him think Miller was.
Yep, autoclaved the whole joint. Fed a bunch of extra energy in and popped him like balloons.
They can't still do that, though, right? I mean, if the things that ran this are all gone, no one to pull that trigger. It won't do that to us. Miller's grim smile chilled Holden's blood.
I keep telling you, this station is in war mode, kid. It's playing for keeps.
Is there a way we can make it feel better about things?
Sure. Now I'm in here, I can take off the lockdown, Miller said. But you're going to have to...
Miller vanished.
To what? Holden shouted. I'm going to have to what?
From behind came an electronically amplified voice.
James Holden, by authority of the Martian Congressional Republic, you are placed under arrest. Get down on your knees and place your hands on your head. Any attempt to resist will be met with lethal response.
Holden did as he was told, but turned his head to look behind. Seven Marines in recon armor had come into the room. They weren't bothering to point their guns at him, but Holden knew they could catch him and tear him to pieces just using the strength of their suits.
Guys, seriously, you couldn't have given me 5 more minutes?
Chapter 26 Bull. Voices. Light. A sense of wrongness, deep in places he couldn't identify. Bull tried to grit his teeth and found his jaw already clenched hard enough to ache. Someone cried out, but he didn't know where from. The light caught his attention. Simple white LED with a sanded backsplash to diffuse it. An emergency light. The kind that came on when power was down. It hurt to look at, but he did, using it to focus. If he could make that make sense, everything else would come. A chiming alarm kept tugging at his attention, coming from outside, in the corridor. Bull's mind tried to slide that way, going into the corridor, out into the wide, formless chaos, and he pulled it back to the light. It was like trying to wake up, except he was already awake. Slowly, he recognized the alarm as something he'd hear in the medical bay. He was in the medical bay, strapped onto a bed. The tugging sensation at his arm was a forced IV. With a moment of nauseating vertigo, his perception of the world shifted. He wasn't standing. He was lying down. Meaningless distinctions without gravity, but human brains couldn't seem to help trying to assert direction on the directionless. His neck ached. His head ached. Something else felt wrong. There were other people in the bay, men and women on every bed, most with their eyes closed. A new alarm sounded. The woman in the bay across from him losing blood pressure, crashing, dying. He shouted, and a man in a nurse's uniform came floating past. He adjusted something on her bed's control board, then pushed off and away. Bull tried to grab him as he went by, but he couldn't. He'd been in his office. Serge had already gone for the night. A few minor incidents were piled up from the day, the constant friction of a large, poorly disciplined crew. Like everyone else, he'd been waiting to see whether Holden and the Martians came back out of the station, or if something else would. The fear had made sleep unlikely. He started watching the presentation that the Rosinante had sent, James Holden looking surprisingly young and charming and saying, "This is what we're calling the slow zone." He remembered noticing that everyone had accepted Holden's name for the place, and wondered whether it was just that the man had gotten there first, or if there was something about charisma that translated across the void. And then, he'd been here. Someone had attacked then. A torpedo had gotten past their defenses, or else sabotage. Maybe the whole damn ship was just coming apart. There was a comm interface on the bed. He pulled it over, logged in, and used his security override to open its range to the full ship and not just the nurse's station. He requested a connection to Sam, and a few heartbeats later she appeared on the screen. Her hair was floating around her head.
Null G always made him think of drowned people. The sclera of her left eye was the bright red of fresh blood. "Bull," she said with a grin that looked like relief. "Jesus Christ, with